Marlins Hot Stove Show with Glenn Geffner is on.
Tyson fires, Morneau swings, loops one into center field. Out goes Etch, a long way out. He dives and makes the catch to save the night.
940 wins.
How about that for thrills?
Miami Sports.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Marlins Hot Stove. Now only 11 days away from the first workout of the spring up in Jupiter on February 20th. I think I say this at this time just about every Monday night, but I'll say it again tonight. And I do say so with a great deal of conviction. We've got two jam-packed hours of Marlins talk in front of us. So much to get to, and with each passing day, so little time. I want to change the conversation a little bit on tonight's show. I think this is the 12th or 13th Hot Stove show we've done this winter. We've spent so much of our time talking about the changes the Marlins have made since the end of last season. All the new faces who've been brought in hopes of getting this team back to the playoffs for the first time since the championship season back in 2003. But I also think it's important to remember that Michael Morse and Dee Gordon, Martin Prado, Matt Latos, Ichiro, David Phelps, Aaron Crow, and the other newcomers aren't likely to get this team to October without the continued growth and the continued production of Marlins holdovers. Guys like Giancarlo Stanton, Marcelo Ozuna, Christian Yelich, Steve Cishek, and come midseason, the returning ace, Jose Fernandez. And the bond that connects the five players I just mentioned, they're all homegrown stars. They were originally signed, developed, and brought to the big leagues by the Marlins. For all the trades and free agent signings, player development remains at the core of this team's chances for sustained success over the long haul. And with that in mind, we're going to spend much of tonight's show on just that topic. Coming up in just a minute, I'll be joined by the Marlins Vice President of Player Development, Marty Scott. Later in the show, going to talk with two of the organization's top prospects, the 2014 Organizational Player of the Year, catcher JT Realmuto, who made his Major League debut a season ago, and also lefty pitcher Justin Nicolino, the Marlins Minor League Pitcher of the Year in 2014. Nicolino, who could well reach the big leagues for the first time this season after turning in a remarkable year at AA in 2014. We'll also have a Kyle Seeloff conversation with Jeff Conine. We'll get Mr. Marlins' thoughts on this 2015 ball club. And Kyle's going to talk to him about the role he plays down on the farm with Marlins minor leaguers. And finally tonight, we'll wrap up our preview of the Marlins National League East Division rivals. In recent weeks, I've talked about the Mets, the Nationals, and the Braves with their radio voices. Tonight, we'll close the NL East loop with a conversation with Tom McCarthy, the television play-by-play voice of the Philadelphia Phillies. So as advertised, it is indeed a busy next couple of hours coming up. With our focus, as I said, firmly on player development, welcome our first guest of the night to the show, Marty Scott, heading into his fourth season as the Marlins Vice President of Player Development. He's closing in on 40 years in the game. Marty, it's always great to talk with you.
Well, it sounds like I'm old, but I'm glad to be here. It's always good to talk to you, Glenn.
Let's dive right into things here. It's been a great winter for the Marlins, but I think on some level it's got to be a little bittersweet from your perspective. As the man who oversees the organization's farm system, you take great pride in seeing players climb through the minors and establish themselves in the big leagues. But there are other times, like this winter, when an Andrew Heaney, an Anthony DeSclafani, an Austin Barnes, a Domingo Germán, and others are traded away. Obviously, everybody's ultimate goal is to win at the major league level. But is it tough for you to see prospects traded away?
Well, I think, you know, if I was young and then just now starting my career in player development, I think it would get to me a lot more. But since I've been around the block and been a part of this for so long, you know, our job in player development is to get guys ready for the major leagues, hopefully within your own organization. But if you don't, and there's other teams out there that are interested, and there's a piece of the puzzle that helps us win at the major league level, you got to pull the trigger and, you know that you've done your job to develop them and at least get them on a road where other teams are interested to fit that puzzle with your major league club that helps you win.
You know, we saw that being a key this offseason as these players I mentioned have brought back some very important players for this 2015 Marlins club. Now, we talk about developing players in the minor leagues. I'm not sure that most of our listeners have much of an understanding of all the manpower and all of the resources that an organization dedicates to developing players. Your administrative staff, managers, coaches, roving instructors, can you take a minute to explain the number of people who are going to impact a player in this organization on his way to the major leagues?
Well, the minor leagues have changed a little bit, Glenn, from when I first got into this. Years ago at the Texas Rangers, we only had four minor league clubs. And, you know, it wasn't as big a business as it is now. So consequently, major league clubs today feel like the broader base you have, the more players that are within your organization, then the better chance you have of hitting on some of these guys and getting profound major league players out of it. I haven't seen the numbers in the last few years, but the number used to be, Glenn, one out of every 187,000 players that play little league, high school, or college ball gets a chance to play pro ball. And you feel like once you're drafted and you're in a professional environment that you've got those numbers beat and the odds are in your favor now. But still only 1.8 or 2 out of 10 get to the major league. So it's still an uphill battle. But, you know, again, our job is to get people ready for the major leagues. Certainly as many trades as we made this year involving minor league players, then our, you know, our overall depth has suffered just a little bit. But we got some good minor league players in return. We had an excellent draft last year that will get the ball rolling again and get this whole cycle going again. So if we have a need at the major league level, we've got somebody in place. And if we've got guys in place at the major league level that are here for several years, then we've got some time to provide that depth again by developing our players within the organization.
You've got your managers, your coaches, your rovers who are around these players every day at the minor league level. This organization is lucky in that it also has some other sets of eyes I know you're able to use in evaluation as well. Guys like a Jack McKeon, Hall of Famers like Tony Perez and Andre Dawson, Jeff Conine, who's going to be on the show later tonight. How much are they able to help in evaluation and in some case with instruction with some of these guys?
Well, I kind of dodged the question earlier, but about the staffs that we have, and we've got good, young, aggressive teachers, guys that are psychologists, that are baseball-knowledged, guys that can teach the game of baseball, but they're the big brother for guys that are homesick. I mean, they have to fill a lot of hats and a lot of roles as they develop these players. When I mentioned how small farm systems were years ago, usually just a manager. When I played, a couple of minor league teams I played on only had the manager. And then once I got into player development, then we added a pitching coach on each club. But today, each one of the Marlins minor league teams has four coaches, the manager, a pitching coach, a hitting coach, and then a utility coach. And not quite the major league staff, but certainly a better ratio for these guys to get individualized instruction. And then you throw in, like you said, these guys that have been in the game so long that have something to give. You know, Jack McKeon's one of my best friends, and when I came over and knew he was here, then we work hand in hand together. And you know, people ask me how I've survived for 40 years. Well, I come to the park every single day expecting to learn something, and when you've got mentors and people with experience in the game like a Jack McKeon, where you can pick his brain and he sees things that you might not see. It's sometimes I liken player development into, you know, with the individual managers that are there every day with the player. Sometimes they might not see a change in a swing or a change in a delivery because it was so subtle in a daily basis, where a guy that hasn't seen a kid for a month or so can instantly notice a change in his approach at the plate or approach in his delivery. And guys like McKeon are outstanding. And then you throw a guy, Jeff Conine, who's not that far removed from playing, but still has the game in his blood. He's always going to give something back. He wears many different hats with the Marlins, but he truly is Mr. Marlin with everything he does for the team, the community. And when the minor league players see a guy like that come around, they feed off that. They love to pick the guy's brain and find out, because he was there. He experienced these things of adversity sometimes that a player experiences in the minor league. And he might be able to give something to a kid, not only with changing his stroke or changing his throwing mechanics, but just the everyday grind that that professional baseball puts on these kids, because you're only as good as your next game. And, you know, I've seen a lot of guys with a lot of talent at the minor league level that couldn't handle the daily grind because their highs were too high when they performed well and their lows were too low when they struggle. And consequently, it's the guys, maybe sometimes with less talent, that stay on the even keel, that approach the game the same every single day and don't get too happy when they're the hero and don't get too sad when they're a goat. And, you know, Jeff's experienced that, every aspect of it. So him relaying that information to players is invaluable.
Talking with Marty Scott, the Marlins Vice President of Player Development. Back in the 60s and the 70s, they talked about having the Orioles way in Baltimore. There was the Dodgers way, organizations that had tremendous continuity and were able to get to the point where they taught things at the lowest levels of the minor leagues exactly the way they teach things in the big league. So when you arrive in rookie ball in the Gulf Coast League, you're doing things the same way they're doing them at the major league level. With the continuity we've begun to see here in this organization in recent years, is there a Marlins way that's developed that is passed down from the big leagues to AAA all the way down to the Gulf Coast League?
Well, that's something that I've always believed in, and something that last year in the new regime of Michael Hill and Dan Jennings that we talked about, developing a Marlins way. And, you know, my previous years that I was here, sometimes it's tough, or even the years before I came to the Marlins, when you change staff at the major league level and bring in new people, there's different philosophies, different ideas. Doesn't necessarily mean one's wrong, right, or indifferent. But when you change every single year or every other year, and the minor league players, the emphasis they put on learning the new things, whether it's pickoffs, rundowns, approach to how to pitch to a certain type hitter, all the intricacies of the game, and you change all the time. Sometimes those players, it's like, well, what are we going to learn this year? You know, and they don't put maximum effort in learning or their approach, because they know next year there's going to be a change at the major league level, and then we'll have to go with something different. And that's something years ago in Texas, we did the same thing. We changed managers a lot, and we developed a Ranger way of doing things, and now we've developed the Marlins way of doing things. And certainly the continuity with Mike Redmond's extended contract and the fact he's going to be here. I was looking over the major league staff a while ago and their roles, trying to get in my mind what assignments is going to be in major league camp, and to see all the same names, that's a blessing in disguise. And, you know, we want to develop minor league coaches as well as players, that someday they might get that opportunity with the Marlins, but if they don't, it's another opportunity presents itself where they paid their dues and they're qualified people, that they get an opportunity somewhere else. We hate to lose them, but it all goes hand in hand, kind of like those minor league trades. You know, develop the staff as well, and then if things don't open up here, be happy for them, proud that they've earned a shot somewhere else.
Want to get into some individual players I want to get your thoughts on later in our conversation. Before we get there, Marty, a couple other big picture type questions for you. From a developmental standpoint, we've talked about some of the prospects you've lost this winter, but at the same time, is it fair to say that bringing impact big leaguers in from the outside helps you on your end, because it gives you the chance to have more developmental time for some people in the minors rather than having to rush them to the major leagues?
Well, that's another thing that I like, is the fact that you know, we've got established major league guys in there now that can probably do the job and will do the job, and you don't have to kind of do it piece by piece and give somebody a tryout at the major league level, and then if he doesn't perform, send him back down to the minor leagues. Whenever there's a move that requires a need at the major league level, I want to send guys that are tested at the minor league level and are ready at the major league level, where it's not a revolving door, where they come up, they do the job, they stay in place, and they never come back to the minor leagues. That's not always the case. You have to do it sometimes when someone's hurt on a 7-day DL or a 14-day DL, and you know in 14 days he's going to be back in the minor leagues. But, you know, it's just our job to make sure that we've got all the holes filled, no matter what they are and no matter what the length of time that the major league club needs it. But ideally, when a guy moves up to major leagues, we want him to stay.
Got a couple of the Marlins' top prospects coming up later in the show tonight. Justin Nicolino and JT Realmuto. They're both a big part of helping Jacksonville win a championship in Double-A last year. I think a lot of the time, Marty, when fans think about developing future big leaguers, they look at minor league baseball as a collection of individuals, and everybody's basically concerned with doing whatever he has to do to climb the ladder, get up to the next level. But last year in Jacksonville, we'll use that team as an example, what you saw there really was an amazing team effort. 10 straight wins to close out the season just to make the playoffs, and then a nearly perfect run through the postseason. From your perspective, how important is developing that team concept, and how important is getting players used to winning when they're in the minor leagues?
Well, that's another aspect of the Marlins' way, and I'm a firm believer that guys that know how to win, that have won in the past, that have experienced playoff-type baseball, that experienced a pennant race, it's invaluable to player development. It'll make them better when they're faced with those same challenges at the major league level, and it make them a better player. They become leaders. They've experienced, problems, or their backs up against the wall. And certainly, as you mentioned, Jacksonville had their backs up against the wall. It's uncanny. and to get in like they did and to win the last 10 games just to make the playoffs, especially when the team you're chasing goes 9-1 the last 10. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just unbelievable their season. And, you know, you couldn't write a script any more of a Cinderella story than those guys. But, you know, what they experienced, you can never take away. And it's like you said, minor league baseball is, you know, you emphasize team and you emphasize winning, and certainly all the managers manage to win. But it is player development, and sometimes you could be on the worst team in your respective league, but that doesn't mean because you haven't performed well that you're not going to move up to the next level. And consequently, you could be on the best team, but if you didn't perform up to your capabilities or to show the improvement that you need to move up to the next level, you might have to repeat. So it is a lot of individual type performances, but those good individual performances over the course of the year make a winning team and help those guys. And that's something, if they never play in the major leagues, Glenn, they're going to have that championship ring on their finger for the rest of their lives.
For sure. We want to talk about some of the individuals. You were just talking about individuals here and there. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, more with Marty Scott. We'll get into Justin Nicolino and JT Realmuto. Tyler Kolek, a name that's been brought up on this show. A lot of callers are interested in Tyler Kolek's progress, the number one pick from a year ago. So we've got a lot more with the Marlins VP of Player Development, Marty Scott. Stay with us. Just getting started tonight, talking Marlins baseball until 9 o'clock on Marlins Hot Stove. Stay with us. Back after this on 940 Wins.
Baseball's burning questions all winter long. Winter long. Fire up the stove with the Marlins' Glenn Geffner on 940 Wins.
Right around third, Ozuna the throw to the plate, and Wright is out at the plate. Ozuna throws out the tying man for the second out of the eighth.
Miami Sports.
Talking baseball, talking Marlins baseball, talking the future of the Marlins tonight with the Marlins' Vice President of Player Development, Marty Scott. Marty, want to get to some of the players who are going to constitute that future, some sooner rather than later. And I want to start by asking you about Justin Nicolino, who's got coming up later in the show tonight, coming off a terrific year at AA, the organization's Pitcher of the Year, the Southern League's Pitcher of the Year last year at Jacksonville. Not your prototypical pitching prospect, in that he doesn't put up big strikeout numbers, but give us the scouting report on Justin Nicolino heading into the spring.
Well, first thing you can categorize Justin is, or in, is the fact he's a pitcher. He's not a thrower. He's not going to set record numbers on the radar gun, but his mound presence, his approach, how he goes about his business, his repertoire of pitches, how he works hitters, keeping the ball down in the strike zone. You know, it's just fun to watch him, as meticulous as he is, how he goes about dissecting hitters up there and how many times going into a game, how relaxed he makes the rest of the team feel, because they know, even though we have pitch limits and inning limits, that there's probably better than 95% chance he's going to give you 7-plus innings if his pitch totals are low, and consequently everybody can relax and just play ball. But that's the type of guy he is. He's got to field his position well. He's got a good pickoff move. But, you know, there's an old adage that I heard or learned when I was a young player, and, you know, back then it was a lefty throwing 85 will beat a right-hander throwing 90 every day of the week. Well, the numbers, kids are stronger now, and the numbers have gone up. So Nicolino's a guy that throws 90, and he'll go out and beat a right-hander throwing 95 every day.
And you talked earlier about when teams win at the minor league level, you get to see players perform in a pennant race in the postseason. And this is a young man who last year down the stretch was really at his best late in the regular season and in the postseason for Jacksonville.
Well, you know, I think one of the best things as far as his development goes is that he didn't have to get rushed. He was there the entire year. He was Pitcher of the Year. He experienced that award and that accolade, and as well as the championship. And, you know, I really think that if you ask him if he would have rather been a AAA at the end of the year or involved in what the Jacksonville team went through, he wouldn't hesitate and say he was right where he was supposed to be.
Guy who was right there behind the plate with him for most of the season last year, JT Realmuto. He was the organization's Player of the Year last year, and for a guy who spent most of his time in high school playing shortstop, how dramatic are the strides he's made behind the plate as a professional?
Well, I first saw him when I came aboard in the fall of 2011 in the playoffs at Greensboro. So here's his second championship, and he's been in the playoffs almost every year. So here's definitely a guy that's a winner. Here's definitely a guy that has experienced championship teams, and he's in a position that not only requires him to perform, but also requires him to be a leader And when he's been a leader on the field in that type of environment, when there's so much on the line, it has really enhanced his career. When I first saw him in 2011, it was hard for me to believe that he just started catching. I mean, he looked like a young, undeveloped kid, but at the same time, how he received the ball, set up, how he blocked balls, how gritty he was, you know, I knew he was something special. And we've been patient with him. We haven't had to rush him, had other guys in place. And, you know, he went through the same thing last year. He did get a couple of call-ups and some big league time, which helped him immensely. And I think made him a better player when he went back to Jacksonville. But there's a guy that we didn't have to rush, that he went back, got to be involved in all they went through, and it's really helped his career. And it's really easy to see not only more consistency at the plate last year. I think he was a point shy hitting 300 and he had 60-some RBIs, but also behind the plate, his leadership, knowing how to call games, working hard behind the plate, not getting lazy, just reaching for balls, but getting out there and blocking balls. And I think he threw close to 40% of the runners out at second. So, you know, he was a guy to contend with in the league. Guys didn't run on him. And it's easy to see not only why he was a Double-A All-Star, but our player of the year.
He was a state championship high school quarterback back in Oklahoma also. You talk about that leadership. I got to imagine some of that might even go all the way back to his days on the football field.
I think he's the best athlete in the organization. There's a lot of things athletic-wise that this guy can do, athleticism. I know he's not supposed to be playing, but I'm sure he sneaks out once in a while. I know he can dunk in basketball, he's got that commodity that a lot of catchers don't have. You know, you usually think he's a squatty body. Catcher's a squatty body type guy that can't run. This guy can run. He can steal a base for you, too.
Yeah, he stole 15 bases last year, double on top of everything else. I've gotten a bunch of calls over the course of the winter doing this show, people asking about Tyler Kolek, the Marlins' number one pick out of high school last June. He's got that 100-mile-per-hour fastball. Obviously very young, with a lot of work ahead of him still, but what did you see from Tyler Kolek in his pro debut?
Well, I think when he came aboard, he was tired. You know, he pitched a lot of innings in high school, but hitting triple digits all the time with his fastball there and dominating, you know, the school that he went to in Texas, they had a couple of good teams in their district, but overall, you know, he just basically mowed everybody down. So consequently, sometimes when things are easy on a young player, they've got to get in the professional life and suffer a little adversity, take a step back or two before they take a step forward. And that I think Tyler did that when he first came on. Maybe, and I'm not trying to put words in his mouth, but maybe he thought he'd come in and dominate just like he did in high school, but he took his lumps, and he had a little setback with a little injury, a muscle in the back that bothered him for a little while. But, you know, you look at his numbers, and, you know, he's 0-3 and 4.50 ERA. You'd say, boy, those are disappointing. Absolutely not. As far as from a development standpoint, what he experienced, the adjustments that he learned to make, and I really feel like an instructionally, when the Gulf Coast season was over and what he did instructionally, you know, he came in and was still learning that day-to-day grind and those day-to-day workouts that he has to do, where in high school, you know, you play two or three times a week and that's it. And you had to get used to being on the field every single day and learning every single day and not realizing, because he suffered some adversity, that he was going to have to sit back and learn, listen to the coaches, learn professional hitters, and improve his work ethic. And I think it was one of the first or second days of instructional league where we have a lot more private instruction with the players. That's why it's called instructional league. They have a lot more private instruction, a lot more one-on-one type things. And he was overwhelmed of what we did the first couple of days. And in fact, I think he made the comment to one of the coaches, "Are we going to learn everything in one day?" And so consequently, you could tell that he was tired and just overwhelmed with the routine and what he was going to have to go through. At the end of that four-week period, he wanted more. He had learned so much and had matured so much. And we got to remember that still he's going to play all this year at 19. And, you know, because of the situation at the major league level and what we have within the organization, there's absolutely no reason to rush him at all. I think his velocity will come back because he's going to be fresh. And his velocity was still well above average, even though it you know, wasn't hitting triple digits there at the end, but it's just a matter of him getting his rest and coming into spring training healthy and ready to go. But, you know, sometimes, like I mentioned, we all want to learn something every single day. He's a guy that comes to park with his passion for the game and what his desire now of wanting to learn and knowing what he needs to do, that you even learn from him. I even learn from him and how much his attitude and work ethic and just overall savvy of the game of baseball and love for the game really, made an impression on me for sure.
That's great to hear. We've got a couple more minutes with Marlins VP of Player Development, Marty Scott. I want to ask you about a couple other upper-level pitching prospects who could potentially make an impact in the not-too-distant future. Marlins took a lefty reliever, Andrew McCurahan, from the Cubs in the Rule 5 draft this year. I know he's a guy you saw in the Southern League last year. What was it about this left-hander that enticed the organization to take a Rule 5 gamble on him?
Well, he's a little bit different than most pitchers in professional ball that have had success as a reliever. He was a reliever in college. You know, he wasn't a starter, so it's something he's been doing his entire life, which usually, as a guy proves he can't start, you always have the better arms, and especially at the lower minor leagues, you have the better arms starting because for them to get better, they need innings, and the only way they're guaranteed regular innings is to start them, and then you make an adjustment later in their development to put them in the pen or setup man or situational lefty or whatever it is. This is a guy that did it in college. He had success there, had success so far in pro ball. And then the second difference, and rather than the prototypical reliever, sometimes they have, you know, most relievers need two quality pitches they can concentrate on and maybe a third. He's got four. And, you know, he doesn't try to outthink or do too much. He just has got a great sinker and he's got a great breaking ball, but he can throw a slider and he's got a decent changeup. And, you know, our scouts of all the Rule 5 guys that we've taken since I've been here, by far, his scouting reports with our pro scouts that saw him pitch, as well as our minor league staff that saw him pitch in the Southern League, he's got about as high scouting numbers as I've seen.
That's left-hander Andrew McCurahan. We'll keep an eye on him this spring with Dan Jennings traded to the White Sox. You've got Mike Dunn, one lefty in that bullpen. Potentially Brad Hand could be a long man, another left-hander, but McCurahan, a guy will watch closely up in Jupiter. We could do this all night. We're running out of time. I want to ask you about one other pitcher who I don't think gets talked about as much as maybe he should. We heard about Heaney and DeSclafani and Nicolino last year at AA, but there was another pitcher, Jose Urena, who every time you look up is pitching brilliantly, very steadily climbing his way through the organization the last few years. He throws a ton of strikes. What does Urena need to do to make that last step?
Well, I think continue to succeed at every level. Last year he won 13 games with a 3.3 ERA at Jacksonville, part of the championship again. But since he's been in the organization, whether it's pitching in Jacksonville or when he was pitching in Greensboro a few years ago, I think when I'm traveling around and you talk to scouts in other clubs or at their winter meetings when you're trying to do deals and certain names come up, I believe his name is mentioned more than anybody outside of Jose Fernandez that we've ever had.
Wow.
So he's got some potential that not only, you know, in some organizations are guilty of hyping their own guys, but the hype is there outside the organization as well. I mean, he's asked about and talked about, and performance-wise has shown that he can, and he's performed at every level. So, you know, again, no need to rush. I think he'll get an opportunity in spring training to impress and then go to AAA, and if we have a need during the year after 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 starts, then I think that he might be ready for a call. If not, if he has to stay the whole year at AAA, that's fine too. And, again, the challenge for us is to make sure that there's guys in place when the need arises, that no matter what position it is. I think another closing thought for me, the thing for me, Glenn, one of the big challenges this spring is to I'm going to have to walk around with a roster in my hand. You know, the 65 guys we've got coming to camp right now, 26 of those, including our non-roster invitees and the new players on the major league rosters, 26 out of 65 will be wearing the Marlins uniform for the first time.
Mm-hmm. A lot of new faces, a lot of energy, a lot of excitement, and a lot of good stuff to talk about down on the farm. I wish we had more time. We talk about not having to rush players. We got to rush out of here, though. Marty, great stuff. We'll talk to you in Jupiter quite a bit, I'm sure, and really appreciate you taking the time tonight.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
All right, that's Marty Scott, the Marlins Vice President of Player Development. When we come back, going to talk to catcher JT Realmuto. He was the Marlins Minor League Player of the Year last year, made his big league debut, 11 games in Miami. JT standing by in Oklahoma. He's coming up next, right here on Marlins Hot Stove.
Baseball's hot stove season is here. The Marlins' Glenn Geffner is on 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Base is full of Marlins, 1-1, inning number 4. There's a shot up the middle. Realmuto's got his first big league hit. In from third comes Jones. Here comes Ozuna. There won't be a throw. JT Realmuto's first hit in the big leagues. A two-run single to give Miami a 3-1 lead in the fourth.
Here's the 2-0, and a ball bounced over third, and a fair ball down the line to the left field corner. Home to score is Garrett Jones. That's a tying run. Here's the go-ahead run. Reed Johnson being waved is Justin Bour. He'll score. And pulling up at third base, JT Realmuto. He pulled a ball over the bag at third, right down the line into the left field corner, and he just promptly emptied the bases. He's at third base, and the Marlins now with a 6-4 lead.
A couple of memorable moments from the 2014 Major League debut season of catcher JT Realmuto, who joins us now to get our bottom half of our second hour started, our first hour started here. It's Marlins Hot Stove tonight. JT, thanks for taking the time tonight.
Absolutely, Gary. Thanks for having me.
11 days until the first pitchers and catchers workout up in Jupiter. You ready to get things started?
Absolutely. Getting excited. Off-season's always fun for the guys, but the second half of it definitely gets boring, and everybody gets pretty excited to go, so I'm ready to get started.
What is your off-season routine like? I think you spent most of the off-season back home in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah. I spent just about all of it in Oklahoma City. I spend a lot of time traveling, going to see family. Other than that, I just kind of hang out, work out, hit, throw, do all that stuff, get ready for the season to start.
Talking with JT Realmuto, who made his big league debut, 11 games for the Marlins last season. He spent the rest of the year helping Jacksonville win the Southern League Championship. JT was the Marlins Minor League Player of the Year. Hit .299, had a .369 OBP in AA, banged out 38 extra base hits, hit 8 home runs, drove in 62, stole 15 bases, had a terrific year behind the plate. We talked about this, JT, with Marty Scott in our last segment. He was on the show already tonight. You were primarily a shortstop in high school. How'd you end up behind the plate?
Well, as you said, most of the time I was a shortstop in high school. I caught a little bit for my summer ball teams every now and then. And then as far as school ball goes, I only caught maybe 2 or 3 games. But the Marlins just happened to show up to scout me for one of those games, and I just happened to be catching. And after the game, the scout, Steve Taylor, he told me that he liked intangibles behind the plate, and they were thinking about moving me back there.
How long did it take for you to really feel like a catcher?
Oh, it was definitely probably a good season and a half in before I really started to get comfortable. And even to this day, you know, I still have to make minor adjustments, still trying to learn the position. But for the most part, I feel like I'm starting to get the hang of it.
Now, you were also the quarterback on a state championship football team in high school. We think of the quarterback taking charge, being the leader on the field. How much do you think your football experience prepared you for the responsibility you take on as a catcher at the AA level, at the big league level?
I think it helps a lot. As you said, being a quarterback, you have to be the leader of the team. And I believe as a catcher, it's the same situation. You kind of have to take charge of the team and be the leader. And I feel like my football days really helped me in that sense. And I think that as a catcher, you don't always have to be vocal as much, which I'm not a really loud guy, but you kind of have to lead by example and take your guys to battle. So I feel like my high school days as a quarterback helped me out a lot with that.
You got into 11 games with the Marlins last year, 7 starts behind the plate. A lot of people talk about needing a little bit of time to slow the game down when they first get to the big leagues. They say the game just moves faster than it did in the minor leagues, particularly with all that's on a catcher's plate. I know you didn't have a ton of time up here last season, but did you feel like you were able to settle in a little bit at the big league level and make it easier for you moving forward?
Yes, absolutely. Even though I didn't get a whole lot of games, and as you said, I think I got in 11 games or something, just all the time being up there, getting that experience, getting to see how everybody goes about their business. As you said, it's definitely a faster-paced game. and it's going to take a little time to adjust, but just being up there, having that time to get under my belt, it really helped out a lot.
The Marlins have a couple of veteran catchers on the roster right now, Jared Sautalamacchia and Jeff Mathis. But a lot of folks feel like you're going to be the long-term answer behind the plate for this team before too long. I've had several pitchers tell me how much they learned from Jeff Mathis. Between spring training and your time in the big leagues, is he a guy who's been helpful to you in your development?
Absolutely, 100%. Just like those pitchers said, he's a guy that everybody on the field can learn from. And it's very special for me to get to learn from a guy like that because he goes about his business the right way. It's on the field and off the field, in the clubhouse. He treats everybody with respect. He plays the game the right way. He's the perfect veteran to have in the clubhouse to treat everybody how to play the game.
Talking with JT Realmuto, you're heading into your sixth professional season here in 2015. What are some of your priorities, some of the things you're most focused on improving heading into the spring?
Just got to kind of keep trying to get better at every aspect of the game, honestly. Nothing in particular, but just try to learn to slow the game down, keep working on my defensive priorities. That comes first. Keep trying to stay consistent at the plate, and everything else will come.
We've seen your name near the top of all the Marlins prospect lists this winter. You've been mentioned in most of the top 100 major league prospect listings. Do you pay attention to stuff like that?
I mean, I see some of it through social media and all that. I try not to pay too much attention to it, but it's hard to stay blind to it, obviously.
I've got another top prospect, Justin Nicolino, coming up on the show in just a couple of minutes. I know you two have worked together a lot over the last couple of seasons. We're hoping that 2015 is the year we see Justin make his big league debut. Can you give us a scouting report on Nicolino? What should we expect from him when he gets here?
I mean, he's just a great all-around pitcher. He's not a guy that's going to necessarily overpower anybody, but he's got four quality pitches that he throws to both sides of the plate whenever he wants to in any count. He's a guy that can pitch into righties, into lefties. I mean, he really dominates with his fastball, not so much with power, but he's very good at locating it. And then as far as his three off-speed pitches go, they're all sharp. He's developing a cutter, which really helped him out the second half of the season last year when he really started to get going. He started to feel more comfortable with that pitch, and it really started to get him dominating hitters.
Nicolino, a guy you've got a lot of familiarity with. When you come into spring training this year, there are going to be a lot of arms you don't have a whole lot of familiarity with, either guys who've been in the big leagues who you haven't caught in the past, or certainly a lot of pitchers new to this organization this year. What's the process like for you getting to know this staff at the big league level?
It's just something that takes time. Like you said, there's going to be a lot of guys that myself, Mathis, or Salty haven't got to catch very much, so it's just going to take time through spring training, getting innings with those guys. Getting behind the plate and catching their bullpens, you know, getting in the clubhouse and just being able to talk to them, ask them what they like to do in certain situations, what's their favorite off-speed pitch, just stuff like that. It's just a repetition type thing where hopefully by the end of spring training we'll be a lot more comfortable with those guys.
Wrapping up with catcher JT Realmuto, had Justin Bohr on the show a few weeks ago, and we talked about this with him. I want to ask you as well, one of the things you were able to do this winter was represent the Marlins at Major League Baseball's Rookie Development Program in Washington, D.C., about a month or so ago, I think. Tell me about that experience. What were some of the things you learned in a pretty unique opportunity?
Yeah, it was a very cool opportunity. Like you said, I think we were there for 3 days in Washington, D.C., and it was just kind of conferences. They talked to us about how to deal with the media, how to conduct an interview, you know, how to stay out of trouble, obviously, stuff with how to work with your finances. They kind of explain everything that you're really going to need to know as your career progresses and you get into the big leagues, and you're a little more in the spotlight, you know. So they help you to get through that stuff and learn how to deal with those situations. It was a really cool experience, and I'm glad I was able to represent the Marlins.
Well, you nailed the interview here tonight.
Thank you very much. They taught me everything I know.
JT, thank you for your time. When are you heading south?
Tuesday, a week from tomorrow, so getting ready to go.
We'll see you in Jupiter.
First for Ironton week.
It won't be long. We'll see you up there.
Awesome. Thank you guys very much for having me.
Thank you very much. It's JT Realmuto, Marlins catcher, the reigning Marlins minor league player of the year from 2014, and a guy we think we're going to be seeing a lot of in the years to come here in South Florida. Offensively, defensively, you heard Marty Scott rave about JT. We saw him a little bit, 11 games last season. And it would appear that he would start this year at AAA, barring an injury. You've got Salt Lamakia and Mathis locked in at 1-2, but a lot of things can happen over the course of 162 games, and we saw Real Muto last year and could very well see him at some point. We'd be surprised if we didn't see him at some point in 2015, but you look at the long term for the Marlins. I think many people expect he's going to be this team's catcher for a long time and a chance to be a very good major league catcher. We'll look forward to watching his continued development here in 2015. Going to take a break. When we come back, going to introduce you to the Marlins minor league pitcher of the year from a season ago, Justin Nicolino, who could well make his big league debut here in 2015. He's coming up next on Marlins Hot Stove.
Keep your hand on the hot stove with the Marlins, Glenn Geffner. 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Justin Nicolino done tonight, but his work that he did this season in Jacksonville will resonate forever. Let's listen to the crowd. Nicolino now in the dugout, congratulated by his Suns teammates. A class act, Justin Nicolino, and Suns fans will long remember his contributions for Jacksonville baseball for years and years to come.
That was Roger Hoover, the voice of the Marlins AA club, the Jacksonville Suns on the call with what had to be an incredibly special moment for Justin Nicolino walking off the mound one final time last season. Came after 6 2/3 scoreless innings against Chattanooga in Game 3 of the Southern League Championship Series. Suns would go on to win the game and capture the league title with a series sweep. Justin Nicolino, the man who led that club all season long, one of the Marlins' top prospects, joins us now. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How you guys doing?
Doing great. Hey, let's start with what we just heard, the ovation you received having just thrown your final pitch in a remarkable season. I think that every pitcher dreams of having moments like that in big games. What do you remember about that night and that feeling?
I mean, it was incredible. It was one of those things that you kind of always live for. You always dream, you know, of getting to walk off a field and, you know, the fans acknowledging, you know, what you got to do. And, you know, those fans, you know, stuck with us that whole season through the good and the bad. And, you know, to have that as my last pitch of the season, to walk off, to hear that, I mean, it was incredible. It was, you know, it was a tremendous moment. And, you know, for me, also too, you know, Barquette came out to get the ball, and he was like, "Listen, he's like these fans are gonna cheer for you." And you know, it was kind of weird how I knew it, and he's like, "Make sure you tip your cap to him." And you know, that's something that you always want to be able to do because you appreciate the fans and the time they show up for you. And you know, it was an incredible moment.
You spent the full season in Jacksonville in 2014, 14-4, a league best .285 ERA in the regular season. You won both your postseason starts and ERA below 2. You were both the Marlins Minor League Pitcher of the Year and the Southern League Pitcher of the Year. From a team standpoint, you were part of something really special in Jacksonville. And for folks who don't know, the Suns had to win their final 10 regular season games in a row just to make the playoffs. You did that, then you rolled through the postseason to win a championship. How much fun was it to be a part of such a special season?
It was incredible. It was one of those things that you kind of just can't believe. You're kind of baffled when you look back at it. And I still am. You know, we were struggling a little bit there in the middle of the season, and we were fighting with Mississippi a lot, and we knew that for some way to get in the playoffs, we had to win out. And we kind of made it a team joke. Like, why not win out, make the playoffs, and just win it all? I mean, because at that point, you kind of want to, you know, take it to a whole new level. And we kind of just showed up to the field every day, relaxed, and knew we were going to win. We just kind of had that feeling, you know, we were relaxed, we were enjoying the game, and you know, having fun together. And it was one of those things that it worked out the way it did. And you know, to go through the playoffs and do what we did, I mean, I think we won at one point, you know, 16 or 17 in a row. I mean, to be part of something like that is even crazier.
And on a personal level, everything really seemed to come together for you on the mound last year, such remarkable consistency from April through September. What was the personal side of the journey like in 2014?
It was fun. You know, I got to play with a lot of great guys. You know, we had our team had a lot of rosters
I mean, within the first 2 months, it seemed like we were having 5 to 6 new guys, you know, every 2 weeks. And you develop a relationship with those guys, and or even guys that are getting called up. You know, a couple of my buddies getting called up, and you know, getting to see them have success in the big leagues and do that. I mean, it's always fun. You get to play with those type of people, but you know, for me, it was just a long process, and you know, it all paid off from my off season work that I put in. You know, there's always goals that you want to reach and have, and you know, I was very happy with my season and what I accomplished. But you know, the big picture for me is to be able to do that in the big leagues one day. So you know, whatever I got to do to keep doing that, that's what's going to happen.
Talking with left-hander Justin Nicolino. Now let's fast forward to 2015. You got the first pitchers and catchers workout in Jupiter, only 11 days away. We know you're knocking on the big league door, as you mentioned. It would seem like a lot would have to happen for you to make this club to start the year, although you never know. With that in mind, what kind of approach do you take to spring training this year?
I'm the same approach that I would take every year. You know, come in, show up, work hard, and just do what I'm asked. You know, you can't. I feel like in this game, you can't go in trying to do too much because this game will humble you in a minute. And I mean, there's been a lot of people that have seen that. And you know, just to have the approach that you're going to come in and work hard and do what you're asked. I mean, I think that's the type of approach that you have to come about it. I mean, because the moment you start expecting and doing too much, that's when you become, you know, that's not who you are. And that's the philosophy I kind of try to abide by.
Now, this has been a fun offseason for Marlins fans with all the moves the front office has made to hopefully put this team right in the thick of the playoff hunt. But I'm guessing it's been tough for you to see several guys you've played with the last couple of years traded away. And I want to ask you specifically about two teammates you pitched with in single-A and double-A the last 2 years. How tough was it to see Andrew Heaney and Anthony DeSclafani traded away?
It was a rough 24 hours, to say the least. We've been sitting around. We all knew at one point something was going to go down. We just didn't know when. And we talked about it all the time. You know, you can't be surprised when that stuff happens. You know, it happened to me in 2012, and I was caught off guard. But you got to realize this game's a business, and you know, whatever's going to be best for the team. And if some other team might want you more than another, and you know, it was a rough 24 hours. But you know, like I said, it's a business, and you know, you at first, you know, you're kind of taken away by it, but I mean, you understand the point of it, and you know, we're all still good friends and still keep in touch as if we were, you know, getting ready to go to spring training together.
Now, you were having the huge year in Jacksonville last year. Both of those guys, Heaney and DeSclafani, were up and down a few times. They got their first taste of the big leagues, and both had some highs and lows along the way. Were there things they shared with you about their major league experiences that you think might help you when you get the call?
Yeah, I mean, they just said it's a whole different. I mean, I guess it's, they said it's a whole different lifestyle. Just the way everything goes. I mean, how quick pace the game is, and you know, how much more, you know, mistakes are exploited. And that's something that's big. You know, that's something that I tried to work on this year is, you know, cutting down on mistakes and, you know, trying to make it simple as possible. And you know, they said that was a big part of their game that, you know, they had to, you know, figure out real quick, and eliminating the mistakes and, you know, taking the outs when they can get them.
Talking with Justin Nicolino. So often, Justin, the pitchers we see get the most attention on their climb through the minor leagues are the guys who put up big strikeout numbers. That's not your game, though. You've averaged 6.7 Ks per nine innings over four minor league seasons, only about 4.5 strikeouts every nine innings at Double A last year. What's the key to success for you on the mound?
You know, it's funny. Everyone thinks that, you know, it's just, you know, I'm not striking guys out. I'm not, you know, able to get guys to swing and miss. And for me, it's just kind of been over the years I've learned how to pitch. I've realized that I don't need to go out there and you know, blow the doors off guys. And, you know, if I can get a hitter out in three pitches or less, then I'm completely happy with that, because I'm more worried about pitching 7, 8, 9 innings than I am about, you know, punching out 15 and 5. You know, I look at it as the more I can help out the bullpen and, you know, and go about that. I mean, that's what I rather do. You know, I'd rather get, you know, 24 ground ball outs and a couple punch outs. You know, it just kind of, it's one of those things that everyone looks at it differently. And to me, you know, I look at it as that's the way I pitch. That's my game. I get outs as quick as I possibly can. And, you know, for me, it's work, and I'm happy with that.
Anything specific you're working to improve as you head into the spring?
Anything specific? Always. There's always something to be working on. I'm always trying to make sure my delivery is consistent, refining my pitches, you know, making sure everything's there, and just trying to stay within myself. Not trying to do too much, not trying to go out there and, you know, blow it by people and, you know, just the normal things that you would think to prepare for a season and stay consistent, you know, and doing the same, you know, same thing I would do in April that I would do in August, September, just, you know, staying within myself and, you know, trying to make sure mechanically I'm the same sound person.
I don't want to look too far ahead, but you're an Orlando native, born and raised in Central Florida. How excited are your friends and family about the chance to make a short drive south at some point before too long to see you pitch in the big leagues?
Oh, I mean, they're always talking about it. I mean, they always ask about it now. Oh, how's Miami? How's Miami? Because, you know, not a lot of people know about, you know, going through the minor leagues and whatnot. But, you know, that's something that is always across everybody's mind that, you know, I'm involved with. And, you know, if it happens, whenever it does happen, you know, it'll be a great experience for everyone.
Last thing before we let you go, the possible introduction of a pitch clock to the major leagues, certainly a hot topic in the last couple of weeks. Justin, if you begin this season at AAA, you're going to have to deal with a pitch clock, which will be used in all AA and AAA games this season. From a pitcher's perspective, you have any thoughts, any concerns about the pitch clock?
You know what? I really don't. I'm a type of person that likes to work quick. Every now and then, you know, I'll take a breather off the mound, but, you know, I'm a firm believer in, you know, in trying to repeat my pitches as quick as I possibly can to throw the hitter off, you know, timing off of balance. And I mean, I'm not too worried about it. I know some guys like to take their time and, you know, they like to, you know, kind of slow the game down, but I'm not too worried about it. I think, you know, I think there's always kind of things that are being implemented into the game and always trying something, and who knows, it might work out, it might, you know, be great for the game. But I mean, to me, it's something that I wouldn't really even worry about.
Oh, belatedly, congratulations on a terrific season in 2014, Justin. I wish you all the best in 2015, and we'll see you in Jupiter in about 10, 11 days.
Awesome. Thank you guys for having me.
That's Justin Nicolino, our guest here on Marlins Hot Stove. He's actually at the Heat game tonight, so he had to step away for a couple of minutes to join us on the show. But some great insight from Justin Nicolino, a young man who has not pitched above AA yet, will most likely begin this year at AAA, could be in the big leagues at some point. But you listen to him, sounds like a seasoned veteran and a guy who knows what he has to do to be successful on the mound. He's not going to blow people away. You think about Randy Johnson going into the Hall of Fame this year, a guy who blew people away, just overwhelmed them. But you think about Tom Glavine going into the Hall of Fame last year, a left-hander, a finesse guy who didn't overpower anybody with his fastball, but he pitched effectively with that fastball by moving it around, by changing speeds up and down, in and out. And that's precisely how Marty Scott described Justin Nicolino. And he's a guy we'll look forward to watching in Jupiter this spring and hopefully at Marlins Park before too long. So we've had a busy first hour on the show tonight. I want to thank Marty Scott, JT Realmuto, and Justin Nicolino for joining us. Coming up in hour number two, going to talk with Mr. Marlin, Jeff Conine, when we come back. I'm also going to preview the 2015 Philadelphia Phillies with their TV voice, Tom McCarthy. Stay with us. A lot to get to between now and 9 o'clock on Marlins Hot Stove.
Marlins Baseball Hot Stove Talk with Glenn Geffner is on. 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Into hour number two, talking baseball with you until 9 o'clock tonight. We heard from Marty Scott, from JT Realmuto, and Justin Nicolino already on our program tonight. Now, time to hear from Mr. Marlin, Jeff Conine. He sat down earlier today with our Kyle Seeloff.
Mr. Marlin, Jeff Conine with us on the Marlins Hot Stove Show this evening. At Niner, it's been quite the off season for the Fish. Plenty of wheeling and dealing, and I'd like to start big picture with you. You're close with Michael Hill and Dan Jennings. I know your opinion is very valued amongst them. How good do you feel headed into this year after the way the last couple of months have played out?
I feel excellent going into this year. You know, we basically retooled the entire infield except for Adania Echeverria. We got one of the better young outfields, maybe the best young outfield in all of baseball, already set in stone. So we made some great improvements in the bullpen, especially all around. I really like the way our team's shaping up.
Taking a look at some of the new faces in the clubhouse now, Michael Morse, Ichiro Suzuki, who I'll ask you about in just a moment, and D. Gordon, just to name a few of the guys. All of those guys with playoff experience, Morse obviously a world champion with the Giants last season. How important is it to have some of that top-notch veteran experience amongst still a very young Marlins bunch?
Well, Well, I think it's very important, especially guys that have been there and done that as far as the playoffs are concerned. You know,
Belich has done a terrific job, to say the least, at the top of the order. But to have a true leadoff guy like D. Gordon with the speed, his ability to bunt and get on base, and a lot of the time single-handedly score a run in the first inning, how valuable will he be this season?
Well, I liken it to, you know, back when we had Juan Pierre at the leadoff spot,
sure.
Someone that could create havoc, so to speak, on the base paths. Defenses, you kind of stretch out the defense with, you know, your ability to bunt like they can. And that only gives the guys behind him a lot better pitches to hit because they're worried about them running all the time.
When you talk about being a veteran, possessing a ton of experience in Major League Baseball, Ichiro Suzuki, by all accounts, is a pro's pro. He's been around this game for a very long time now. I know going back to your playing days, you know Ichiro personally. You also accompanied some of the Marlins executives to Japan a few weeks back for Ichiro's Marlins press conference. What can you tell us about the kind of guy Ichiro is, and how much of an impact will he have on this organization, albeit being the fourth outfielder this season?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a newer type role for Ichiro when he comes here as a fourth outfielder, basically just giving the guys days off as they need them in the outfield, and a tremendous insurance policy in case anybody happens to get hurt. You know, he can step right in, and, you know, he's a game changer as well. He's one of the most dynamic players I ever played against in my playing days. He could hurt you basically in every aspect of the game, defensively. You know, he's won multiple gold gloves. He's just a phenomenal defender. He's got speed. He can hit, obviously, one of the best hitters I've ever seen. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting dynamic, obviously, with the language barrier coming in here.
Sure.
I played with a guy named Brian Roberts from Baltimore Orioles who played with him last year in New York, and he absolutely loved Ichiro, said he was a funny guy, blended very well in the clubhouse, and he said probably one of the most prepared guys he's ever seen as far as going into a game. He prepares himself better than anyone.
When you were over in Japan, through your conversations with Ichiro, how excited is he to come to South Florida? Obviously, he was in Seattle. He's been in New York. But to come to South Florida, a very diverse culture down here, your feeling, was he incredibly excited to get going here with the Marlins?
Yeah, he seemed very excited. His wife was had dinner with us as well. And she seemed very excited to come out to South Beach and kind of experience the Miami culture. You know what? I think he's going to be, just by his presence on the team, I think guys know what his pedigree is and how well he's done in the big leagues. Hopefully can learn a lot from him.
And we'll certainly find out. Mr. Marlin, Jeff Conine with us on the Marlins Hot Stove Show this evening. And Jeff, you, of course, were part of that historic 2003 World Series bunch. Yourself, Mike Lowell, Pudge Rodriguez, Luis Castillo, and several others at the time brought along a lot of veteran experience. Guys like Dontrell Willis, A.J. Burnett, and Alex Gonzalez at the time were fairly young. Do you see any similarities in regards to the culture and veteran experience between that team in 03 and this year's group of guys in the Marlins clubhouse?
Yeah, you know, it's I think the pieces we have in place right now is Giancarlo Stanton, even though he's young, has got 5 years in the big leagues now, so that's getting on the cusp of being a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
Christian Yelich, I think, plays way above his age as far as his baseball mentality and the way he acts and portrays himself in the clubhouse. So even though they're young guys, I think they're mature as far as their baseball acumen and the way they handle themselves in the clubhouse. So I wouldn't consider it really a young team as far as it's young as far as experience, but their attitude and the way they carry themselves, it plays like a much older team. And that being said, when you bring a guy like, you know, Mike Morrison, who can further, you know, work with them as far as just being big leaguers, you know, and getting together on that team concept and being able to express to them what it takes to win a world championship and make the playoffs. That's all invaluable experience and invaluable knowledge that these guys bring to the table. And, you know, Martin Prado, another one that's got the mm-hmm. tremendous experience and a phenomenal player. So I really like the mix of everybody they've got going on right now. And hopefully the young guys will take advantage of their experience and learn from it.
Sure, when you talk about youth on this Marlins team as well, it's fairly easy to point your finger at each and every position and say, well, this guy's in his early to mid-20s, this guy's in his late 20s, this guy's 3 years into the league. You yourself, you're most familiar with the outfield. You've seen a lot of Christian Yelich, Osuna, and Stanton, 23, 24, and 25 years old, respectively, from left to right field here in Miami. Is this the best outfield in baseball?
I will put it up against any outfield in baseball. I really will. You know, We had a left fielder that won the Gold Glove. You had a right fielder that was in the finalists for winning the Gold Glove in right field. And Marcell Ozuna, I'm not exactly sure why he didn't make the top three, but he is another tremendous surprise, I think. I think he took over that center field position and played it a lot better than everybody thought that he might. And confidence-wise, defensively, you got the utmost confidence in those guys. And when you add what they're going to do at the plate as well, I can't think or I can't put together a better outfield, in my opinion.
Jeff Conine joining us on the Marlins Hot Stove Show tonight. Jeff, of course, the injury to Giancarlo Stanton last September is one that nobody wants to look at twice. But by all accounts, he's feeling extremely well. He's healthy. He's looking very good. Given everything surrounding Stanton this offseason, the injury, the big contract, do you think we can expect the same Giancarlo here in 2015?
Knowing him, I think we might expect a better Giancarlo in 2015. You know, he's never really satisfied with his performance. I think he took his leadership role to a new level this year, which really helped out our clubhouse. The guys really look up to him and the way he approaches the game. And, you know, he was almost going to school for to play football. You know,
right.
So I don't think he's really settled into his potential yet fully as a baseball player. And as we see this guy develop this year, I think we're going to be expecting big things, and he's going to anchor this entire Marlins offense.
In terms of an injury like that he sustained last September, there's been a lot of chatter over the offseason. Well, how does somebody come back from an injury like that? And certainly, I'm not too sure. I cannot recall if you ever sustained an injury to that severity, but how tough can that be to get back in the batter's box the first couple of times?
Well, for some guys, it can be very difficult. I never got hit in the face, you know, with a ball like that. I got hit in the helmet a couple times.
Right.
And psychologically, it could play a big factor in a guy getting in there and, you know, reliving that moment, so to speak. So we're not going to know until Giancarlo takes that batter's box for the first time and steps in there. And,
sure.
And I think it'll be evident if there's any lingering psychological effects. You can tell by the way a guy sets up or the way he attacks baseball. I don't foresee any problem. He's going to wear a protective helmet that will guard that face. So even if, God forbid, something did go up and in again, he'd be protected.
Right.
And knowing him, I really don't think it's going to be a problem. I don't. I think he's going to it's not going to be an issue.
Special Assistant to the President, Jeff Conine, with us on the Marlins Hot Stove Show this evening. And switching gears momentarily, there's a lot of youth, plenty of it on the big league ball club, but plenty of it down on the farm as well. Spring training just a couple of weeks away now. Fans will have an opportunity to see some of the Marlins' young rising stars. That's always a fun part of the spring. In terms of player development, I know you're very hands-on with some of the development within the system. My first question would be, what kind of work do you do? And as a follow-up to that, who are some of the guys fans may or may not know about right now that you're especially high on in the system?
Well, I work with a lot of them in spring training, especially the young guys that get called up to big league spring training. Andre Dawson and I are basically out with the outfielders and help any way we can. You know, we're in the dugout during the game, so, you know, we're just trying to help them acclimate to the major league level, for one, and teach them how to be better baseball players. And, you know, as far as what we've got in the minor leagues right now, I know a lot of it you're seeing at the big league level,
right,
that were just in the minor leagues until recently with Ozuna and Yelich, some of our young pitchers. We traded away Andrew Haney, which is our number one pick from a couple of years ago. We traded him away in the D. Gordon deal. Justin Nicolino, Discofani, who we saw quite a bit last year up and down, got traded away as well. You know, some of our young pitchers that we got in these trades that I'm not really familiar with yet, because they're so new, I haven't got a chance to meet them. But I know we got some good talent in return for the trades that we made.
Marlins great Jeff Conine joining us this evening on the Marlins Hot Stove Show. Just a couple more minutes with Jeff. You've known Marlins manager Mike Redmond for a long time, teammates on the 2003 World Championship team. 2013 was quite the first season for Red, to say the least. I think things clearly came into focus last season in terms of the direction in which this organization is headed. But how would you rate the job Red has done in the course of two seasons?
I think he's done a phenomenal job. You know, going from A-ball manager to the big leagues is not an easy task. But the relaxed atmosphere that he brings to a clubhouse, I think everyone kind of feeds off of that and is more comfortable and relaxed on the baseball field. And, you know, Red kind of brings that calming presence. He obviously was a player for a long time. He knows what the grinds and rigors of a major league season are. And he takes that into consideration when he makes out his lineup, and he goes in there and talks to those guys. So I think he's done outstandingly well. And, you know, it's not only making moves in a baseball game that's important for a major league manager. It's managing, you know, 25 different personalities in that clubhouse. And, you know, when you can put out fires early and take care of any issues that might arise in that clubhouse and police it effectively, which he has done very well, you know, I think you're going to have a successful tenure as a manager.
When you talk about the direction in which this organization is headed, I think it's fairly clear at the moment. It's win now, but at the same time, I think the focus has been to win through homegrown talent and through canny and crafty acquisitions, I guess you could say. When you take a look at this potential lineup this season with D. Gordon, Yelich, Stanton, so on and so forth, Michael Morris, Martin Prado, a lot of power and speed, a lot of diversity. How well suited is this lineup or will this lineup be to play and produce inside of Marlins Park?
Well, you know, when you got Stanton in the middle of your lineup, it doesn't matter what park he plays in. You know, Marcell Ozuna had 23 homers last year. The speed factor that we have this year with D. Gordon at the top is something we haven't had in quite a while.
Right.
I think he's – I don't know how many triples he's going to end up with this year, but, you know, gap-to-gap type hitter. Martin Prado the same way. He's not going to hit a whole lot of home runs anyway, no matter where he plays, but he handles that so well. I could see him finding a lot of gaps and hitting a lot of doubles in our park. And, you know, Michael Morris doesn't matter with him either. He's a big-time power guy. And, you know, I think with him especially getting consistent at-bats, you know, he's basically going to be our starting first baseman. He's going to be out there every day, which is a role he hasn't had in a few years. But I think that's going to do wonders for him, and he's going to settle in nicely.
Wrapping up with Mr. Marlin, Jeff Conine on the Marlins Hot Stove Show this evening at Niner. I can't let you go without asking you about the progress you've seen the last couple of years here in Miami. You've been a part of this organization for a long time, and what I'd like to ask you is, how enjoyable has this been from your point of view watching Michael Hill and Dan Jennings strategically mix and match and piece together this ball club since the end of 2013 to what it is today and what hopefully will be a postseason berth here at the end of 2015?
Yeah, you know, getting to work alongside those two, have the utmost respect both as people and their baseball knowledge is just second to none. It's fun for me to be in on these meetings and go to the winter meetings and talk about trades and players and just how knowledgeable these guys are about every aspect of the game, not just, you know, obviously player development. Dan Jennings, that's his big forte, but the business side of it as well. So that being said, when they first came in and they really brought all of us together, everybody in the organization, and said, this is what we want the Marlins organization to look like. And this is kind of a blueprint of how we want to go off from here on forward. And it, a lot of it had to deal with the clubhouse culture and what we want to portray as a team. Because when you look at the really successful teams over the last, I don't know, dozen years or so, you know, everybody points to the St. Louis Cardinals and what they've built over there, and the way their clubhouse is run and, and how they do things within their organization. And I think that's the positive changes that Dan and Mike have both brought to this organization, and we should be looking for big things from here on out.
Mr. Marlin, Jeff Conine, it is always a pleasure to chat with you. Always love picking your brain and getting some of the insight from within the organization. Enjoy the last couple of weeks at home, and we'll see you up at Roger Dean Stadium in just a few weeks.
All right, looking forward.
Good stuff. That was Kyle Seeloff with Jeff Conine. When we come back, going to be joined by Tom McCarthy, the TV play-by-play voice of the Philadelphia Phillies, previewing the Phils next on Marlins Hot Stove.
Baseball's burning questions all winter long. Winter long. Fire up the stove with the Marlins' Glenn Geffner on 940 Wins.
Right around third, Ozuna the throw to the plate, and Wright is out at the plate. Ozuna throws out the tying man for the second out of the eighth.
Miami Sports.
Well, tonight we wrap up our month-long series previewing the Marlins' National League East Division rivals with a look at the Philadelphia Phillies from 2007 through 2011, five consecutive division titles, a couple of pennants, and a World Series championship. But over the last four seasons, they've fallen from first place in 2011 to third place in 2012 to fourth place in 2013 and into last place in the division in 2014, a season to go under first-year manager Ryan Sandberg. The Phillies finished 73-89. And this winter club president, Pat Gillick, and GM Ruben Morrow Jr. seem to be embarking upon a full-scale rebuild. Here to talk about the state of the Phillies, their television play-by-play voice, Tom McCarthy. And Tom, let's start with the big picture here. Obviously, it was an incredible run. I think everybody realized the time for some dramatic changes was coming as the core group of players was getting older and in many cases having a tough time staying healthy. Is there an expectation internally of how long it's going to take before the Phillies can put themselves right back in position to again compete at or near the top of the division?
Boy, it's a good question, Glenn. You know, we've been asked about that during the last couple of weeks after Pat Gillick and Ruben both said that they were going to basically rebuild this team. Pat, you know, kind of said that 2017 is the target for the ball club, and I think that's somewhat realistic. They've got some pretty good fielding prospects, hitting prospects in the minor leagues, but those guys are still a couple of years away. So I think couple that with the fact that the free agent class next year is a decent free, well, not decent, it's a very good free agent class. I think looking at 2017 as the possible, as the next time that they can compete for the National League East title. As you know, hey, you can catch lightning in the bottle and walk away with this thing because it's still up for grabs the way things look.
You make an interesting point talking about next year's free agent class. This is a team that, while it may be in rebuilding mode, has some contracts certainly, would like to get out from under right now, but this is a team that's got a lot of money to spend moving forward.
I would think so, Glenn. I mean, within reason, you know, they're going to try to do it a little wiser this time. You know, the money that they spent previously was for a lot of their core players. But I think that moving forward, they're going to try to stay young, get younger, and, you know, make sure that when they do make a splash in free agency, that it's the right splash. You know, somebody like a Cliff Lee, when they brought him back, that was the right move at the time. It just didn't pan out. You know, when they brought in Raul Ibanez to help shore up left field after Pat Burrell moved on, that was the right move at the time. It just didn't lead to a world championship. So, yeah, I think just trying to be wise with their money more than anything else.
Most notably this winter, Jimmy Rollins is now a Dodger. It sounds strange to say that.
That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, Marlon Byrd is a Red. There's a chance that Jonathan Papelbon and maybe even Cole Hamels and Cliff Lee could be out the door in the weeks or the months ahead. How far do you think this teardown goes?
You know, I think it depends because somebody like, let's say, Cole Hamels is 31 years old. And let's say if it takes them 2 years to rebuild, he's only 33, which James Shields just signed a very lucrative contract basically at that age, although he'll be 34 during the season. So I think if Lee's healthy, he's going to get traded. I think if they can find a match for Papelbon, he's going to get traded because they've got depth in their bullpen. But, you know, the Hamels thing is interesting. I think that they may do it, but I think it's got to be the right deal. They have to be kind of blown away because they can't just give him up for nothing.
And that's the thing with Hamels. He's the one guy it would seem you could make that Herschel Walker trade with and really turn your franchise around by dealing Hamels.
Yeah, I mean, think about a couple of the moves the Phillies made years ago, the Schilling deal, the Rowland deal. You know, some people say that they didn't get enough. And I think for Schilling, they probably didn't get enough. I mean, Padilla turned out to be probably the best guy in that deal. For Rowland, Placido Polanco probably became the best guy in that deal. But they probably didn't get enough for those two stars in previous trades. So they've got to make sure that, or even the Cliff Lee trade a few years ago to the Mariners, they didn't get enough at all because none of those guys are contributing in the big leagues. So you've got to make sure, and you know, the Marlins have been good at this over the years. You got to make sure that if you are going to trade your superstar, that you're going to get guys back in return that are going to help this ball up and help them maybe not right now, but help them 2 years down the road for a long period of time.
These are huge decisions this franchise has to make right now.
Huge.
Now, Pat Gillick was the architect of the great run. Ruben Morrow Jr. replaced him as GM. Now Gillick is back as the club president. With everything going on right now, what's the decision-making structure? Who's calling the shots?
Well, I think Gillick is basically overseeing what Ruben's doing. Ruben is going and getting the deals done, and then he'll run them by Pat. I think Scott Krofrock, his assistant, has a say in it as well. So Pat's overseeing the baseball part of it, and then Mike Stiles is kind of overseeing the business end of it. So Mike doesn't have a say in personnel. It's basically Pat that will say, okay, I'm okay with you making that trade, or yes, go sign Chad Billingsley for $1.5 million, you know, or trade Marlon Byrd to the Cincinnati Reds for this prospect who's supposedly very good. So it's Pat, basically, that's making those decisions.
Talking about the Philadelphia Phillies with their television play-by-play man, Tom McCarthy. Now, Tom, it's no secret the Phillies would love to get out from under Ryan Howard's contract. Ruben Amaro has gone so far this winter as to publicly say the organization would be better off without him. Obviously, he's not an easy guy to trade with his medical history and his contract. Assuming he's in Philadelphia on opening day, though, do some of the things that have been said get forgotten, or do they make it tough for everybody moving forward?
Boy, it's a good question. I was up at the MLB Network today, and I was asked that same thing. And I think Ruben's been very honest this offseason. I think they'll be able to move forward. I believe that he and Ryan have had conversations. They're on good terms, and I think that's the key. Whether they trade him or not, they would like to trade him, but he's making $25 million a year coming off a so-so season, even though he was just on the doorstep of 100 RBIs. To me, he'll be the opening day first baseman. How long will he be there? And that's a great question. I think if he has success, shows he's healthy, then they could trade him to an American League team. But if not, they've gone on record saying that they expect him to have 100 RBIs and 30 home runs, and if they're going to keep him, they're going to run him out there to be their first baseman every day.
It's going to be strange. He's somebody other than Jimmy Rollins and shortstop for the Phillies.
We've
heard the name of prospect J.P. Crawford as the long-term solution. Is he the guy? And if he is, how far away is he? What happens in the meantime?
Well, I think he's going to start in Clearwater, which is the Phillies single-A affiliate in the Florida State League. I think that there's a chance he moves up quickly to Reading. Pat Gillick said the other day, we were out at a luncheon together, and he said, listen, if he shows he can do it in double-A, there's a chance he comes right up. But he's probably, I would say, middle of 2016, Glenn, I mean, to be conservative about it, maybe even toward the end of 2016. He's just a young kid, but they have an unbelievable amount of confidence that he's going to be a bona fide major league shortstop. Now, will he be Rollins? Pretty hard to be a borderline Hall of Famer. I think you have to let that kind of unfold. But I think that they're excited about his instincts, his defense, and about the potential for his offense.
And is Freddie Galvis the guy in the interim?
I would think so. You know, they've talked about going out and getting some other guys. They've picked up Tyler Green, people like that. But I would think it's Freddie's job to lose. He's not going to hit the way Rollins did. He's got to shorten his swing a little bit. But defensively, I mean, he's a lot like Echeverria, the way he can play shortstop. I mean, he's a whiz. I kind of liken him to Andrelton Simmons in Atlanta. I mean, he can move, and he can pick it at shortstop.
I want to come back to Rollins for a second. I know at this point, because of the ages, trading Cole Hamels would be a bigger deal in the baseball sense than trading Jimmy Rollins late in his career. But because of what Rollins has meant to that franchise for so long, how big a deal was it to see him traded?
I think it was a huge deal. I went into this offseason thinking, all right, we're going to move some of our veterans. I thought he or Chase Utley would be the last ones to go, to be honest with you. But, you know, he said that he would go to the Dodgers, and they were able to work out the deal. But I think it's huge. I mean, when I say that he's a borderline Hall of Famer, I'm not saying that he is, but statistically, and I know, you know, you and I and Dave have talked about
Yeah, we have. I was going to ask you about that. I think he is a Hall of Famer.
His numbers his numbers have to be part of the conversation when he's all said and done. Now, will he get in? Probably not, but it's going to be close. You know, Larkin's in, so you'd have to at least talk about Jimmy Rollins.
Mm-hmm.
Larkin has more all-star appearances, a better batting average, better on-base percentage, but throughout the, you know, across the board, his numbers are going to be better, power numbers, you know, all those things. So it's just going to be weird to see. I thought he finished his career in Philadelphia, to be honest with you.
We saw Jake Diekman and especially Ken Giles really burst onto the scene in the bullpen last year. Those two look like back-of-the-bullpen forces for the long haul. We've seen Cody Ashe, we've seen Michael Franco get their feet wet a little bit. When you look at the roster the Phillies have today, and obviously a lot can change with a major trade or two, who are the players already in this ball club who you think are real building blocks for the long haul?
Well, I do think those guys in the bullpen are the building blocks. You know as well as I do, it's really hard to find those kind of pieces in the bullpen. So they've got that, and they're young and healthy. They'll keep adding to that. I think that Cody Ashe and Michael Franco, who is going to get a chance this year, you know, those guys are they hope going to be part of the foundation for the future. I do think that they feel like Dominic Brown can turn it around. If he doesn't, then this is it for him, I mean, mm-hmm. from a Philly standpoint. So I would think the locks are the guys in the bullpen, and obviously if they keep Hamels and Franco and Ash. Beyond that, you could, in 2 or 3 years, see an entirely different team from top to bottom.
And that's amazing, because you think back to the run over those 5 years, it was as though Charlie Manuel never had to rewrite the lineup card. It was the exact same guys every single night. You had that unbeatable rotation. You had such stability. I could write down the Phillies lineup before I left the hotel every day, because you knew who was going to be in there.
There were times where I had the whole nine, all the filled in statistically notes, everything by the time I arrived at the ballpark. And all I had to do was open the book for the game itself.
Exactly. Hey, let's assume Hamels is still around. Let's assume Cliff Lee is healthy and still around. You've added Aaron Harang this winter. You mentioned Billingsley's name. How does the rotation shake out?
Yeah, I think that there's some question marks toward the back end, but I do think it's going to wind up being Hamels and Lee, 1-2. And then somewhere in there, it is going to be Jerome Williams and Aaron Harang. I think Harang will be the third. Jerome Williams, and then a mixture of other guys vying for that fifth spot. Billingsley, I don't know how healthy he is at this point. He's going to have to earn his way. Buchanan, I think, pitched well enough where he's going to be given every opportunity to win that fifth job. And I think as the season goes on, you're going to actually see Aaron Nola, who was the Phillies' first-round pick last year out of LSU.
I was surprised. He's not going to be in big league camp, though.
Yeah, I think that they feel like I think they're okay with that. Yeah, you know, I was a little surprised by it, too. And Ruben basically said, I think we know what he can do. I think we know that he just needs to progress as a pitcher. So let's not give him, let's not have him in camp early. Let's have him come with the minor leaguers. He's going to wind up starting in Lehigh Valley, and then he'll eventually progress, you know, I think, up to the big leagues in a very short period of time.
There'll be a Nola in Marlins big league camp, though. His older brother, Austin, is an infielder in the Marlins organization. He'll be in big league camp this year.
Now, is he going to go to big league camp, or is he going to be in the minor league?
He's
camp?
A non-roster invitee, but he'll be in big league camp with the Marlins.
See, that's the maybe that's the thing. Maybe they had to deal with the Nolas.
That's right. Only one Nola at a time.
That's exactly one Nola in a big league camp at one time.
Austin Nola, who wears his last name on the front and the back of his jersey, playing at AAA New Orleans. The last couple of minutes here, talking to Tom McCarthy, the TV play-by-play man for the Phillies. How's the fan base responding to what's going on right now?
Well, I think they realize what's happening. I don't think they're happy about it, but I think they realize what's happening. You know, they got a taste of winning, as you said, you know, for those 5 straight years. And I don't think that they want this taste of losing to linger. I mean, nobody does, but I think their expectation is that this is a big market club that has the ability to spend money. And in order for this team to be successful, they're going to have to spend money. And I don't think that they're going to sit too kindly to this being a long-term rebuild. That's why I think when they said 2017, they were being conservative, but I think they would like to be competitive by the time next year rolls around.
Last thing for Tom McCarthy. I want to ask you about Ryan Sandberg. It seems like he walked into a tough situation. Managing in the big leagues for the first time, he inherited a veteran club, entering a time of transition. He replaced a hugely popular manager in Charlie Manuel. How did the first full season go for Sandberg, and where do you think he looks to improve in year number two?
I think his big thing, honestly, is communication. You know, I think he was a very good communicator, at least it seemed that way in the minor leagues, but I think in the majors, he's still trying to figure that out, which is interesting because he was in major leagues for so long. But I think he wants to improve from that standpoint. I think the game, I think there are certain things about the game he needs to improve on, too, and I think he'll be the first to tell you that, but you know, he's got Bo as his bench coach, and that definitively helps out. But I think communication, because I think that the times last year where the clubhouse may have gotten away from him a little bit, and he doesn't like that feeling. And I think that's one of the things that he's really going to try to improve on this year.
Some great insight on the Philadelphia Phillies from Tom McCarthy. Tom, thanks for the time. And I don't think we'll see you this spring, but we'll see you in April.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. That's Tom McCarthy, the television play-by-play voice of the Phillies. It was a remarkable run from 2007 through 2011. Not only did you know you had a tough game on your hands anytime you played the Phillies, but you knew you were going into that ballpark, Citizens Bank Park, and walking into one of the great environments in all of baseball. You could not get a ticket. Everybody wearing that Phillies red everywhere you looked, and now times have changed. This game is cyclical. You know, the Braves had that 14-year run. Then a down period, then up, and now they may be down a little bit. The Yankees had their ups and downs, and then the huge long run, and 2 years without the playoffs for the Yankees now, and some think it'll be a third straight year with no postseason for the Yankees. The Red Sox, the Dodgers, you go down the list. Everybody's had their ups and downs. This game is very cyclical, and after a long run of huge success in Philadelphia, it's a time of rebuilding right now for Pat Gillick, Ruben Amaro, and those Phillies. And from the Marlins' standpoint, they hope they can take advantage of those Phillies, maybe get a little payback after the last several years have not gone very well when the Marlins have matched up with the Phillies. Even last year, with the Phillies falling into last place, they gave the Marlins a real tough time, especially in that ballpark, Citizens Bank Park, one of the great atmospheres in baseball. It's going to feel different going in there in 2015, but the question is how long before it changes back. They've got tremendous resources. They signed a huge TV deal a couple of years ago. They've got a fan base that you know will pack that ballpark when the team is winning. So they've got money to spend. Now it's a matter of clearing some salaries, making some smart trades. As Tom McCarthy pointed out, if they're going to trade Cole Hamels, they've got to make a good trade. The trade's got to work because they've made some other big deals in past years that haven't worked out for them as well. And the Marlins have been in the same position just about every team in baseball. You can say the same thing about. But these are critical decisions. It's a critical winter and a critical next couple of years for the Phillies. Hard to believe we go into a season, and the Phillies are, I think, universally expected to finish last in the National League East after that great, great five-year run where they were as consistently good as anybody in all of baseball. We'll take a break. When we come back, we've got a chance to open up the phone lines. If you want to jump on board in our final minutes here tonight, if you have any Marlins questions or comments, 866-801-0940, the number to call. 866-801-0940 to talk baseball with you for about another 20 minutes tonight. It's Marlins Hot Stove back after this on 940 Wins.
Baseball's hot stove season is here. The Marlins' Glenn Geffner is on 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Final 15 minutes or so talking baseball until 9 o'clock tonight on Marlins Hot Stove, one of our final Marlins Hot Stoves for 2015. We are, as of today, 9 weeks away from opening day, April 6th, against the Atlanta Braves at Marlins Park. Your first chance to get opening day tickets will be at the Marlins Winter Warm-Up at the ballpark on Saturday, February 21st. It's coming up. Bring the family to Marlins Park for a day of fun. You can purchase single-game tickets for the 2015 season for the first time, including opening day tickets. You can select your seats for season tickets and mini plans. You can get autographs from Marlins players and alumni, enjoy games, activities, music, all kinds of entertainment for all ages. It's the Marlins Winter Warm-Up, and it's coming up Saturday, February 21st at Marlins Park. Go to marlins.com for more info. That Marlins Winter Warm-Up will be the culmination of a full week of Marlins caravan activities throughout South Florida. All the players will be in town for a series of events, including the Jack McKeon Celebrity Golf Classic, which will be held on the Wednesday of that week, February 18th. It'll be at Crandon Golf at Key Biscayne, and it's not too late to head out for that event. Foursomes, individual spots, and sponsorship opportunities are available. You can join Marlins players, coaches, executives, and other celebrities for an exciting day of golf at the luxurious Crandon Golf Course overlooking Biscayne Bay in downtown Miami. If you're interested in the Jack McKeon Celebrity Golf Classic coming up on Wednesday, February 18th, call 1-877-MARLINS, or you can go to marlins.com/golf. You don't want to miss the Jack McKeon Celebrity Golf Classic. And we'll have details to come, but I think we're going to be broadcasting live from both of the events I just mentioned, the Jack McKeon Celebrity Golf Classic on Wednesday the 18th, as well as Marlins Winter Warm-Up at the ballpark on Saturday, February 21st. So hopefully you will swing by and say hello. A lot going on in the baseball world, a lot going on in the Marlins world. Happened to tweet this out a little before showtime today. Just saw the first national pundit to predict a Marlins run to the World Series in 2015. Bob Nightingale from USA Today, very respected baseball writer. He was writing in a piece about James Shields going to the Padres, about the teams that have helped themselves the most this winter, and he lists the Marlins among those teams, certainly, and then he writes, okay, I'll go ahead and say it. I'm picking the Marlins to be in the World Series. Probably have to get into the playoffs as a wild card team with the powerful Washington Nationals, but they grabbed an ace in Matt Latos, a durable starter in Dan Heron, and they rebuilt their infield with Martin Prado, D. Gordon, and Michael Morse. Don't forget, they'll have ace Jose Fernandez back sometime this summer, too. So Bob Nightingale jumping on the Marlins bandwagon, the first national writer that I've seen, at least, picking the Marlins to win the National League pennant in 2015. Some other Marlins notes. Late last night, the club announced that Mike Dunn had agreed to a two-year contract worth $5.8 million, thus avoiding arbitration. A couple of things of note with this agreement. First of all, in the past, it had always been the Marlins' ownership's policy that once the team and an arbitration-bound player exchange the proposed salary figures that are going to go to the arbitrator, negotiations would be over. The Marlins are one of several teams, one of probably six or eight across the major leagues, that have historically gone with the file-and-go philosophy. No more negotiations after the two sides exchange the arbitration figures. But in this case, the first-ever exception to that rule under this Marlins leadership. The two sides exchanged salary figures a couple of weeks ago, but they were still able to hammer out a two-year deal. So after winning an arbitration case against Matt Latos, Marlins get this settlement with Mike Dunn in a two-year deal, and their lone remaining arbitration-eligible player is David Phelps, the right-handed pitcher who was acquired from the Yankees earlier this winter. We'll see what happens there. Now, secondly, what this Mike Dunn signing means, and more importantly, let's look at what locking Dunn up for the next couple of years means to the Marlins bullpen. It's a unit that I think hasn't gotten a whole lot of discussion this winter, largely because as a group, one, they did a really nice job in 2014, and also because there won't be a whole lot in the way of change in that bullpen from last year to this year. For all the turnover on the Marlins ball club, the bullpen is not going to see a lot of change. There'll be some, but not a lot. You know that Steve Cishek's been terrific in the ninth inning for the last 2.5 seasons. He's emerged as one of the more reliable closers in the game, so you feel great about the ninth inning when you've got the lead with Steve Cishek back there. Mike Dunn from the left side is coming off what I think you would call his best career major league season. He's had 4 years in Miami, before that a little bit of time with the Yankees and the Braves. For Mike Dunn last year, a career low FIP, fielding independent pitching, one of those advanced statistical metrics that you hear talked about sometimes. The second best whip of his career for Mike Dunn, walks plus hits divided by innings pitched, essentially base runners per nine innings. A career low walk rate for Mike Dunn. That was a great development in 2014. A career best strikeout to walk ratio, while he posted more than a strikeout per inning, as has been his career norm. So career best year for Mike Dunn. You've got Cishek, you've got Dunn, you've got A.J. Ramos in that bullpen, who took a big step forward last season. A.J., who finished 7-0 at 2.11 ERA. We come back to FIP again, fielding independent pitching, right in the same neighborhood as Mike Dunn's. Better than 10 strikeouts per nine innings for A.J., a career low whip, walks plus hits divided by innings pitched. Only 5.1 hits allowed per nine innings for A.J. Ramos in 2014. He's as tough to hit as just about any reliever in baseball, but what he's got to do, and he'll be the first to tell you this, is bring that walk rate down. He knows it. Six walks per nine innings last year, about the only thing holding A.J. back. That's an area where if he can improve, he could be looking at a future major league closer in A.J. Ramos. Tough to hit. Only 5.1 hits allowed per nine innings for Ramos last year, but the six walks per nine innings at times made things tense. We said it over and over on the broadcast. The only time A.J. gets in trouble is when he starts walking people. Brian Morris was a terrific addition to this club when he came over in the May trade with the Pirates last year. Had a 0.66 ERA in 29 games for Miami, a 3-1 strikeout to walk rate. Like Dunn and Ramos, he can pitch anywhere from the seventh inning on. Aaron Crow, former Kansas City Royal, acquired in a trade this winter. Another big arm added to this bullpen. He's one of the new faces you'd expect to see in the pen. He's a newcomer in 2015. You add in Sam Dyson coming off a breakthrough season, maybe a David Phelps or a Brad Hand as a long man if they don't end up in the rotation. There's some other young arms as well. A handful of more veteran non-roster invitees we'll see this spring who you never know could force their way onto the ball club. And I thought it was interesting over the weekend hearing Marlins GM Dan Jennings in a radio interview say that the club is still looking around, that there's a chance they could still bring another player or two to camp. Some have taken that to mean that maybe Francisco Rodriguez could be in the Marlins sights. K-Rod's still only 33 years old, still a free agent, coming off a 44-save season and an all-star selection as a Brewer this past year. He's the owner of 348 career saves, six seasons with 30-plus saves. He's led the league in saves three times in his career. He'd be another very interesting addition to what's already shaping up to be a terrific bullpen. But we'll see. There's been some speculation about Francisco Rodriguez possibly being a Marlins target. You put it all together, with or without another addition or two, and this bullpen has a chance, I think, to be a real strength for the Marlins ball club. If you get six or even better, seven innings out of your starter, that bullpen ought to be able to lock things down. Last year was the second year in a row the Marlins set a club record for the lowest bullpen ERA in franchise history. It's happened now in three of the past 4 years. There's every reason to think the pen could be even better here in 2015. Some Major League Baseball news today. The James Shields watch is finally over. The last big free agent has finally signed. It's not been announced officially yet, but word is Shields and the San Diego Padres have agreed to a four-year contract worth about $75 million. Shields is a San Diego native, still lives in San Diego, so he's going to his hometown team. He's pitched for Tampa Bay and Kansas City, now coming to the National League for the first time. John Lester got $155 million from the Cubs earlier this winter. Max Scherzer got $210 million from the Nationals. Shields comes up well short of those dollar figures, but another nice addition for the Padres, who've had a terrific offseason. Shields last year pitched for Kansas City, helped the Royals win the pennant in the American League, went 14-8 with a 3.21 ERA, made 34 starts, threw 227 regular season innings. You go back to 2007, since the start of that season, he's averaged 14 wins a year, 33 starts, 223 innings per season, with a 3.26 ERA since the start of 07. And he's done that pitching exclusively up to now in the American League and most of the time at Tampa Bay in the American League East against some powerhouse Yankees and Red Sox teams in some small ballparks against some good lineups. So James Shields going to the San Diego Padres. Why did it take so long for Shields to sign? Some would look at his record and say, well, he's been so reliable over the years. Others think maybe at the age of 33, all the heavy workload might catch up to him. He's thrown more pitches than any pitcher in baseball since the start of 07, with the exception of Justin Verlander of the Tigers. Verlander, a couple of years younger, and he's had some issues the last couple of years. He's not been quite as effective as he had been throughout his career up until 2013 and 2014. So maybe that's why it took a while for James Shields. Some might speculate he was hurt by a rough postseason for Kansas City in 2014, 1-2, a 6.12 ERA, and 5 October starts. Gave up 36 hits and 25 playoff and World Series innings. You wonder if he paid a price for that. But the bottom line is Shields is a San Diego Padres. So you look at those Padres now, and somebody asked me on Facebook today, how good do I think the Padres are? I think they're a lot better than they were a year ago, and they're probably, you could argue, the only team in the National League West that'll be better in 2015 than they were in 2014. And yet, that said, the Padres, a 77-win team last year, just like the Marlins, they still, to me, have a lot of questions. You look at the outfield, this was the lowest-scoring team in baseball last year, and they're counting on their all-new outfield to help them. They brought Justin Upton in from the Atlanta Braves. Upton has been a very streaky hitter, at times can carry a team. Early in September last year, we were talking about Upton as a possible National League MVP candidate, but he's a guy who may have his power sapped some moving to Petco Park. He's a free agent after next season, so he's got a lot on the line in 2015 playing for the Padres. They brought Matt Kemp in that big deal with the Dodgers to play center field. Matt Kemp, can he stay healthy with all the knee and ankle problems he's had in recent years? If he's healthy, if he's the Matt Kemp we saw in 2011, 2012, boy, that's a tremendous boon for the Padres. But can he stay healthy? Can he stay on the field? They're gambling on Will Myers, the former top Royals prospect, former Tampa Bay Ray, was a rookie of the year at Tampa Bay 2 years ago. Had a lot of injury problems last year. He's not performed to this point at the big league level the way many thought he would. It's not a great defensive outfield. You can ask questions offensively about each of those three guys. Padres infield, not going to give him a lot of offense. You look at the UM alum Yonder Alonso at first base, who's not put it together offensively at the big league level yet. Jed Jerko, a question at second base, had a real down year at the plate last year. Probably Alexi Amarista, maybe Clint Barmas at shortstop, good gloves, not a lot of offense there. They're going to bank on Will Middlebrooks at third base, who would appear in 2015. Middlebrooks, who just stopped hitting after getting off to a decent start as a Red Sox a couple of years ago and was basically expendable, had lost his job in Boston. They've had a Derek Norris, good bat behind the plate. They got some questions in the rotation. They've got a good rotation, no doubt. Everybody's healthy and productive. Andrew Cashner coming back from injury. Tyson Ross had a great breakthrough season in 2014. Can he do it again in 2015? They've added James Shields now. They've got Ian Kennedy, a perennial 180, 190, 200-inning pitcher in that rotation as well. They got a good bullpen in San Diego. It's going to be an interesting team. Again, I think the most improved team, maybe the only improved team from last year to this year in the National League West. But can they leapfrog the Dodgers? Can they leapfrog the defending World Series champion Giants? It'll be interesting to see. To me, you can draw some parallels between the Padres and the Marlins. Both teams had identical records last year. Both teams have had major makeovers this offseason. But in my opinion, the Marlins can have a really successful season this year if most guys in this team basically do what they've done in the past and what they've done in the recent past, last year in 2013. Padres have a lot of questions. They're banking on some guys coming back from injuries, some guys bouncing back from down years. Padres have more questions to answer, I think, whereas the Marlins would seem to have more sure things. How does it play out over 162 games? Well, we don't know. Can't promise anything. But I was asked on Facebook this morning to compare the Padres and the Marlins, and to me, there are just more sure things here in Miami than you see in San Diego. Padres have made some great moves. Folks in San Diego are excited. It's great to see. Great ballpark. Should be a fun atmosphere at Petco in 2015. But are the Padres a playoff team? Even with all they've done, I'm not sure. Only time will tell. It's interesting. You look at the Nationals, to me, the class of the National League East, the class of all of Major League Baseball. After Washington, to me, there are probably 8 or 10 teams that could be the second, third, fourth best team in the National League in 2015. And I firmly believe, we've talked about this over the course of this winter here on this Hot Stove Show every Monday night, I firmly believe the Marlins are right in that mix. And it's going to be a fun season of baseball coming up. It all gets started in Jupiter 11 days from today. That'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank our guests tonight, Marty Scott, Justin Nicolino, JT Realmuto, Jeff Conine, and Tom McCarthy. Thanks to our in-studio engineer, Mike Lacomiak. And as always, thanks to you for joining us for another edition of Marlins Hot Stove. If you missed any of tonight's show or want to go back and listen to past shows, all of our Marlins Hot Stove shows are available online at marlins.com/hotstove. They're also available as free podcasts at marlins.com/podcasts and on the iTunes store as well. Don't forget, back with you for another 2 hours of Marlins Talk next Monday night at 7. We'll have more Marlins talk, more Marlins guests. Spring training now only 11 days away, so keep your radio locked right where it is on your home for Marlins baseball all season and all off-season long. Miami Sports Station 940 Winds.